This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday was World AIDS Day. It has been observed every year since 1988 as an opportunity for people worldwide to unite in the fight against HIV, show their support for people living with the virus, and to commemorate people who have died. We hear lots about populations throughout Africa being decimated by the disease, but many people may believe that we've gotten a handle on it here in this country. But consider this, 4 out of 10 Americans living with HIV/AIDS live in the American South, and Mecklenburg County has the highest number of HIV/AIDS cases in North Carolina. But why? What's been going on in the fight against this public health epidemic in the last 25 years? Today, a closer look at the realities of this disease and public awareness of it, and we'll find out about research coming out of North Carolina that is driving international standards for treatment. We're joined in our Spirit Square studio by Dr. Mark Johnson, medical director at Carolina's Medical Center's Infectious Disease Clinic and a member of the board of RAIN, the Regional AIDS Interfaith Network, a recipient of numerous awards for his dedication to HIV care. He also served as physician advisor to Magic Johnson for the I Stand With Magic campaign and is an associate professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. And joining us by phone is Dr. Myron Cohen, the Jurgen Bate Eminent Professor of Medicine, Microbiology, and Immunology and Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His research focuses on the transmission and prevention of transmission of HIV, and it is his research that I referenced in the opening about setting international standards. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
And also in our studios, Johnny Wilson, who is a young man living with HIV. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you for having me.
According to one source that I read over the weekend, every 9.5 minutes, someone in America contracts HIV. Now, given the length of time that we have known about this disease and known about how it is transmitted, why is it still so high, the incidence of transmission? Dr. Johnson.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the issues here is that we have really basically put a lot of resources into identifying, testing, and treatment, but there are certain pockets of the American population that have not been adequately, I think, tested and then allowed to access medical care and services that would allow these individuals to receive appropriate treatment and care.
And we'll talk about those pockets of the population that you're talking about as we go through the program. Dr. Cohen, your research demonstrated that antiretroviral treatment of people with HIV infection prevents the sexual transmission of the virus. So talk about that treatment, the HPTN-052 trial. Who gets this treatment?
So we did a very large study that was reported a couple of years ago that demonstrated that when you're dealing with, and these were heterosexual couples, that probably needs to be emphasized, when you're dealing with couples, one person's HIV positive, the other's HIV negative, when we effectively offered treatment to the people who are HIV infected earlier in the course of the disease, and that has been, that's an important point, we were able to virtually stop transmission to the uninfected partner. And that's been extrapolated to recognize that early detection and treatment of HIV makes a big difference. If you treat it early with a pill once a day, we take what would otherwise be a fatal disease and make it into a chronic disease that doesn't really shorten life or compromise life, and we render people no longer contagious.
And let's be clear about this. The earlier thought process was that you didn't give antiretroviral drugs to somebody with HIV until, what, their T-cell counts reached a certain low level?
Well, this is very clear in the United States. In the United States, for a whole bunch of reasons, we've said if you're detected, if you have HIV, as soon as the infection is detected, you should be treated and without delay for personal health benefits, which were easily measurable, and for public health benefits. This is not yet a universal standard, but the universal standard is moving towards this right now. In the old days, when people had to take 20 pills a day and the drugs had much more toxicity, they were much more difficult to take, then there was a balance between taking these pills that made you feel sick, perhaps, and otherwise compromised certain parts of your health, had adverse effects, and stopping the replication of the virus. Nowadays, with the drugs that are available now, we have more than 30 drugs, and the best combinations are provided in one or two pills a day. this is becomes a no-brainer that people should be treated much earlier and probably immediately.
Why did you choose to study heterosexuals in your study, given the fact that I believe it is still true that the predominant number of people with HIV are gay people?
Gay men, to be specific. Not true.
Okay.
Let me clarify that. This is not an epidemic about one kind of population. It mostly reflects the ability of the virus to go from one person to another with different efficiencies. And certain sexual practices have better efficiencies than other sexual practices, rendering, as Mark said, pockets of populations that are at greater risk with a higher incidence and prevalence of disease. But worldwide, this is a heterosexual disease because there are more heterosexual couples, and the epicenter of this epidemic is in Africa, where heterosexual behavior is more common than homosexual behavior among men. And so this is a disease of everyone, not just of one population. So we had wanted to enroll both heterosexual couples and gay couples, but for a whole bunch of reasons, it turned out that I wouldn't call it easier, but it turned out that the study enrolled 96% heterosexual couples, only 4% were gay men. Now, that in no way undermines the idea that in the United States, this has evolved primarily 60-70% into an epidemic of gay men, and especially of gay men living in the Southeast.
Okay. You have to really get down into the nitty-gritty and define it, I suppose, to make it accurate, completely accurate. Mark Johnson.
So I think that, you know, one of the things that Dr. Cohen's study is really important is that this was an international study in mm-hmm. which literally looked at trying to prevent transmission. And I think that Mike has not really told you that this was really the sentinel study, you know, at least in HIV medicine during the year that this was published. And, you know, the results of this study really show that there was a 96% reduction of transmission in these individuals who were in a large international trial that was mainly, you know, focused on trying to answer one simple question. Could early treatment of individuals who are HIV positive, could we prevent transmission to the seronegative partner? And I think this was one of the successes that Dr. Cohen can clearly, I think, enunciate a little further.
Yeah, how does it work? How does the early treatment, what's happening with the virus when you treat somebody early that it can no longer be transmitted with 96%?
People with HIV, the reason HIV, it's not a particularly efficient virus. It doesn't go that easily from one person to another compared to some other viruses we deal with. For example, if you looked at kind of viruses that cause vomiting, you know, like the norovirus, a single particle is enough to cause an infection. So, and that's why these noroviruses, vomiting epidemics, are so common in the winter, for example. HIV is not that efficient, but the problem is, and Mark said this earlier, people with HIV infected do not know they're infected. That's the number one problem. So they have no reason to be concerned about their sexual behaviors. And number two problem is that people often, for over the years, for mostly because we've given mixed messages, have delayed treatment substantially. So what happens is the virus is replicating and people remain contagious for life. Over the course of a lifetime, people might have several sexual partners, and each new sexual partner would become at risk. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky but important. The person who's chronically infected then infects someone else in a relationship. And suppose that newly infected person, they themselves have another partner. Newly infected people are much more infectious, but almost never detected. So you get a cluster of transmissions. So by treating effectively the chronically infected person, as I've already said, number one, you improve their health dramatically. You render the lifespan normal. And number two, you, as Mark said, abrogate transmission. We really think it's about 100% when people are successfully treated. The one transmission event we saw was explained in a variety of ways because the person had just started on pills. So it's very effective to treat people.
I'm going to come back to your study because the implications are pretty extraordinary, actually, what it could mean going forward. But let's go back to the fact that this used to be a death sentence, and now it's become a chronic disease treatable with ongoing treatment. That's a good thing, but has it cause people to have a false sense of security. I'm not going to get it, and if I get it, everything will be all right, so therefore I'm going to have unprotected sex. What's your experience from a public health point of view, Dr. Johnson?
Well, I think we've made great strides in terms of treatment. You know, back in 1981, this was really an unknown disease, and by the late 80s, we knew at least that this was a virus that was transmitted through various risk behaviors. And now, you know, we stand today with 30-some-odd drugs that can significantly almost render a person's lifespan to that of an HIV-negative individual. Yes, there is still some loss of potential longevity of life with individuals who are on treatment, but we have made, I think, dramatic strides. The real issue here is that I think we've been lulled into a false sense of security with some of these medications, and I think we have to realize that drugs and treatment of HIV is not going to solve this epidemic. We need to really, you know, marshal the resources, I think, for testing and basically identifying individuals, getting individuals on treatment, reducing the risk of HIV transmission here, and basically making sure that we have all the tools that are necessary to really stomp out this epidemic.
You mentioned high-risk behaviors. Obviously, unprotected sex being one, sharing needles would be another. Blood transfusions have pretty much been cleaned up by policy in this country, although there are still problems in other countries with the HIV being transmitted through blood transfusions. Are there any other ways that you can get this virus?
Well, I mean, the other third way is really perinatal infection, but I think, you know, treatment of women who are pregnant, and at least testing of women who are pregnant so that we know those women who are positive and put them on antiretroviral therapy, is really one of the successes of antiretroviral therapy. And we suspect that, I think, perinatal transmission, where a HIV-positive woman transmits HIV to her unborn child, will be a thing of the past. And so when you say that, you know, IVDUs, which is intravenous drug use, has been cleaned up, I don't think that has really happened here. There are still pockets in this country.
No, I didn't say that had been cleaned up. I said the blood transfusion had been cleaned up.
Well, for blood transfusions, I think, yes, it's relatively safe. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the issue here is really is that this is a sexually transmitted disease, and we really should not focus on, I think, the identifying, you know, specific risk behaviors. I think it's unprotected sex of any type that is going to really serve as a vehicle for HIV transmission here.
And without getting terribly graphic, because this is the reading, but this is part of the problem with this disease. This has to be discussed.
Right.
Otherwise, if you are not specific and you don't discuss it, then somebody could get in trouble thinking that they were acting in a safe way. And that's part of the problem here. We don't teach young people today what the problems are, what they face. So without getting terribly specific, because we are on the radio, how is it transmitted? What are unsafe sexual practices?
Any practice in which there is basically a transmission of a body fluid through any type of sexual behavior from one person to another. And so, like I like to tell people, you know, that come to clinic, I'm not like a gymnastics judge here. I don't care what you do. Okay. I just want to make sure that individuals do not transmit body fluids in a sexual act, regardless of who you're with, in a very unsafe manner. I think, you know, if we look at this and we make sure that individuals are educated to make sure that they understand how this disease is transmitted, I think we can start to at least address some of the concerns.
And that obviously includes vaginal penetration. It includes an exchange of fluids. It includes anal, and it includes oral sex. Is that right?
Yes, to a small degree. Oral, possibly, if there is body fluids that are contaminated and during oral sex, yes. So if there's blood, you know, yes. Or if there is vaginal secretions, yes.
We have to stop. I'll let you jump in here, Dr. Cohen, when we come back from the break. We have to take
it
right now. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bragg Financial Advisors, supporting Catawba Lands Conservancy on its efforts to protect local land, natural resources, and our quality of life. Details at catawbalands.org. Well, when you go down the roster of this state's most famous citizens, Billy Graham would probably top the list. Jesse Helms would be on the list. John Edwards and Charlie Rose also would be on that list. But here's a guy that may not pop to the top of the list until you think about it for a second. Bob Timberlake, who is an internationally known artist and designer. He is a native son of North Carolina, has a great deep love for his state, and he's also written, I think, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 books. He will join us tomorrow to talk about all of that and more at 9.
Well,
on the next Diane Rehm show, 2 days after the administration's deadline for fixing healthcare.gov, an update on the federal website for health insurance shopping, other rollout challenges, and political risks for both parties going forward.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about HIV, the transmission of it, research into curing it, perhaps, at some place down the road, and what happens with people who are living with HIV. Dr. Mark Johnson's in our Spirit Square studio. He's medical director of the CMC Infectious Disease Clinic and a board member of RAIN, which is an organization that helps people who have this disease. He's also on the teaching faculty at UNC Chapel Hill in the School of Medicine. Dr. Myron Cohen joins us by phone from Chapel Hill, where he's professor of medicine, microbiology, and immunology. And Johnny Wilson's in our studio. He's a person living with HIV. Before the break, Dr. Cohen, you wanted to jump in here. We were talking about transmission of this virus.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about efficiency, because that becomes an important issue. First of all, to make one thing entirely clear, the blood supply in most developed countries is entirely safe. So tremendous strides went to find every unit of infected blood so that people could be rest assured that when they're getting a transfusion, there was no risk of transmission. And so I want to lay that idea aside in terms of transmission probabilities. That would become zero from the blood supply, or very close to zero. But then when you look at sexual acts, they're not really all the same, and I think it's almost worth being specific. You were trying to drive specificity. Oral sex, male oral sex, that's has a very low probability of transmission, like very, very low, and it's been hard for us to calculate. For vaginal intercourse and for anal intercourse, those are calculated. Those have been calculated with a lot of different tools. And what can be said is that for a whole bunch of biological reasons, anal intercourse is much more efficient than vaginal intercourse, which is why, and it's not just gay men who participate in anal intercourse. Couples, heterosexual couples, participate as well. It's a riskier sex act in terms of the probability of a transmission event. And it's a biological reason, because the tissue is so thin in that area for a variety of reasons that transmission is more efficient. So I think you wanted to get
meaning that there could be an interaction with the blood.
Yes.
Not the blood. The HIV is not just in the blood, it's in genital secretions as well. You don't need blood. It's carried in male and female genital secretions. So when the male or female genital secretions are delivered to a mucosal site, which are all the pink tissues, a transmission event is a risk. And the efficiency is what we try and calculate. And by the way, everything we do then is to reduce efficiency. How do we do that? First of all, we treat people, rendering the concentration of virus in those secretions close to much lower, close to zero, so they can't transmit. On the other hand, you could take pills that we use to treat infected people, give them to HIV-negative people, and potentially protect them. One pill is approved for that purpose. Potentially protect them by bathing the tissues in these antivirals before exposure occurs. And lastly, that's what a vaccine is supposed to do. We're making great progress in vaccine development, and a vaccine is supposed to deliver antibodies to these same tissues so that when the virus finds its way to a cell it can infect, antibody swallows it up before it can infect the cell.
Why, then, is oral sex less dangerous from a point of view of infection?
Well, there's biological explanations and observational studies. So the observational studies suggest that first of all, you got to go back a long way to think about in the very beginning of the AIDS epidemic, we were concerned about intimate contact, toothbrushes and kissing and all that kind of stuff, and all of that proved to be a non-issue. So that's out completely. Then there's the issue, can male genital secretions infect a female or a male if introduced into the oral cavity? And as I said, in one study the transmission was argued to be zero, in another study it was argued to be some small percentage, not zero. So we've never been clear on this. What scientists have done is shown factors in the oropharynx that inhibit acquisition of HIV in the cells of the oropharynx. There's a protein called SLIPI. The saliva is got a high salt concentration. All these things have an adverse effect on the ability of the virus to find a receptive cell and infect the receptive cell. So oral sex, you can't say it's zero probability, but it's a lower probability than other forms of sexual behavior.
From you've talked about detection being all important. Both of you doctors have mentioned detection being the key factor to this. Because if you don't know you have it, you're a walking time bomb. You can infect other people quickly and easily if you don't.
And one other thing, you become sick. You don't need to be sick. There's nothing more tragic than when we admit a patient to the hospital who's got advanced HIV infection that's totally unnecessary. Hmm. So it just is.
So who should be tested and how often should one be tested?
Well, I think there are guidelines out here now that are suggesting that basically anyone from basically 13 to 64 years of age should be tested regardless of your so-called risk. I'd like to, you know, really not talk about risk. I really just talk about behaviors because mm-hmm. I think that's what's important. There are many guidelines now that are suggesting this should be done routinely for everybody.
You said 13, and many people would say, 13? Come on.
Not so.
I have a gentleman here, Johnny Wilson, who is – you're 21, right?
Yes, sir.
And when you're living with HIV. When did you acquire it?
I was diagnosed at the age of 14.
14?
Yes.
Did you know anything about HIV at 14?
Not at all.
Why not?
Just wasn't – not that it wasn't out there for me to know about, but just didn't care to know about it. I was young, didn't think that I would be affected by HIV, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. But you knew about it. I mean, you'd heard
about stories about it. I wasn't properly educated about it.
Okay. Did you know anything about how to prevent it? In other words, would you have taken precautions if you knew how to take precautions?
With the mindset that I was in back then, mm-hmm. I'll probably still say no, mm-hmm. only because, again, you think HIV, you think about older people or people that, you know, 35 and up. You know, as a kid, you don't think about I can possibly be exposed to this disease.
I don't want to get specific, and I don't want names. Do you know how you got this, from whom you got this?
Yes, I do. Was
that person aware that they were carrying HIV?
At the particular time, I don't think so. Again, I would never know because, you know, people, you know, lies and
stuff. And what, was that person substantially older than you?
Yes.
They were?
Yes.
But you just said a second ago that you don't think of getting this disease when you're young. You think of it getting it from and because you're 35 or so years old.
Mm-hmm.
But you obviously had sex with somebody who was
older. Right.
Why didn't that go through your mind?
At that particular time, I mean, as a kid, like, you think you're immune. You think you're invincible, right? So, you know, again, like, I kind of push on HIV doesn't have a look, you know? So I'm at that particular time thinking, oh, if he looks sick, he's sick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you didn't look a certain way, mm-hmm. that particular time, I didn't think that you would be affected by anything.
How did you find out that you had it?
I found out when I was in the hospital. I was in the hospital for a month.
Because of what?
Because of I had the flu symptoms. I was getting real sick. They didn't think to do an HIV test, I mean, an STD check on me because I was so young. So about a month went by. I'm in the hospital having seizures, I was basically having the flu symptoms. And I found out on my birthday. They did like a STD check probably like a week before my birthday. My birthday, they came in and let me know that I was HIV positive.
Happy birthday. What went through your mind?
At that particular time, my family was in a room, so I was more so concerned about what was going through their mind, mm-hmm. And how they felt about me. Number one, I am a gay male, so that was already, at that particular time, a disappointment to them. Now I'm HIV positive. Let's put the icing on the cake.
Yeah. How's that turned out?
After my diagnosis, it actually brought us closer. You know, I was able to talk to them about things that I've done in my past. What I wanted, and without judgment, you know, they talked to me about it, and I guess accepted me a little bit more for who I was.
How are you today? What's your health like?
Yeah, everything's going good. I've been undetectable for a good little while. I started off on the Atripla, which is a one-day pill, and I've been undetectable since then.
Mm-hmm. And has it changed your life, any? How has it changed? It must have changed your life. How has it changed your life?
Oh, yeah. It changed my life. When I first got out of the hospital, you know, it changed drastically. You know, people that wasn't educated, I'm not going to say wasn't educated, was improperly educated on it. Of course, you know, didn't want to talk, shun me, you know, didn't, and that was okay. After a while, once I figured out what I wanted to do with it, who I was, and it wasn't going to affect me like other people are affected by it, I just took it as a, I took it as a learning process. Like, I learned from it. Instead of me going around being depressed about what I have, who I am, and things like that, I just took it as, okay, this is me. It doesn't define who I am. Because mm-hmm. nowadays, with all the medicines and things like that that are out there, you forget that it's actually an epidemic, you know, because like doctors have said, it's turned into a chronic disease when you're properly medicined.
Do you see people your age engage, or do you know of people your age engaging in unsafe sexual practices without even thinking about this disease on a regular basis?
Yes.
Do you understand why they do that?
I don't understand why they do it. Because I think now, since it's been more so a big epidemic as far as in Mecklenburg County alone. Mm-hmm. More people are more educated on it. So it's not like you don't know what is out there. I just think that, you know, we get so caught up in looks. You know, he doesn't look like he has HIV, so
right. Well, you look perfect.
Not?
You look absolutely healthy.
And
I'm told that you describe yourself as a workaholic.
Yes.
So it hasn't slowed you down.
Not at all.
This is not a factor. You take the pill every day and you go about your business.
Right.
And it has not impacted your life. Is he the exception to the rule, or is he the rule today now with these new regimens of treatment?
I think he's the rule.
Yeah, I agree. He's the rule.
And that's obviously a very good thing, but it's also part of the problem, isn't it?
Yes.
Because if you can manage it with a pill every day, what the heck?
It is part of the problem. I think that, you know, when I first started, I was saying there are certain pockets in this country where individuals who are HIV positive almost resemble the infection in third world countries. You know, despite a country which has an unlimited amount of resources here, we still have a group of individuals who are presenting late to medical facilities, you know, with advanced HIV disease. And I think for a lot of the issues that Johnny has clearly illustrated, mm-hmm. I think that people get lulled to the sense of being that, you know, that one pill is going to solve everything. I think there's a lack of education. I think people still aren't feeling that they're invincible. There is this sense of a gay apathy, you know, this is going to happen to me anyway. So why not just, you know, go out with a blaze of glory and enjoy my life and do whatever, because there is a pill out here. I think, you know, these are some of the issues that are driving the epidemic. And, you know, the South is where the epicenter of this infection
well,
is.
Yes. Let me see here. The American South has the largest number of people living and dying from HIV. Mecklenburg County has the highest number of cases in the state. Charlotte is ranked number 10 of metropolitan cities. These are like cities like New York and San Francisco, of the new HIV cases. Charlotte is in the top 10.
That's right.
Mecklenburg County has, on average, 7 new cases reported each week. Now, this goes back to education, it seems to me. And you talked about, Johnny, you talked about other people reacting to you because they were improperly educated
mm-hmm.
about this disease. What did that mean?
It's one thing to be aware of HIV. It doesn't mean that you're educated about it. I think it's more so dangerous to be improperly educated than it is to be aware of it and not be educated at all.
Meaning what?
Improperly educated meaning that, for instance, how it's transmitted as far as the look more so, and what does it look like, and basically just those two more so is what I'm more so leaning towards is, mm-hmm. you know, being improperly educated of how you can get it and being expected to it look a certain type of way.
Is part of the problem that education needs to come early and specifically. It needs to be relatively specific. And in certain school systems, and I believe, and I could be wrong about this, but I believe that Mecklenburg County is among them, you can't talk about safe sex, can you, in the classroom, even in a sex education class?
I'm not really aware of what the rules are for Mecklenburg County schools, but I think generically across this country, you know, the education system has not really done a great enough job, I think, really given people like Johnny and his counterparts the education to really address this epidemic. I think more of these kids know how to use their cell phones and software on computers and things like that than just really knowing about HIV and what to do about HIV and just general basic, you know, sexual health. And so in health in general, I think this is one of the major problems that we have with education right now.
What's the primary impediment to educating?
I can tell you from my experience in New York, being there in 20 years, this has been a lot of times this has been the school system, the parents themselves have been an issue. I have been amazed at the times that have been going to parents of teachers associations, and parents would get up and say, you know, I don't want my son to learn about, you know, anything about gay sex. I don't want them to learn anything about sex. I don't want them to learn about anything that's related to HIV. They basically want to address this with an ostrich.
Is it a discomfort with talking about sex, or is it a discomfort of talking about transmission of this disease? Is it a discomfort simply of not wanting to have their child exposed to homosexuality?
I think it's a culmination of many things. I think, you know, you bring in religion, you bring in your own sexual biases, you bring in, you know, your own lack of education. I'm surprised at how many parents can't even tell their children about the basic birds and the bees discussion and do that accurately.
Are they, when you talk to the parents about the transmission of this disease and the incidence of young people getting it because they are improperly educated, and the numbers that we just threw out here, that Charlotte's in the top 10 of the metropolitan cities in the country where it's transmitted, does that change their point of view?
Yeah, I think it does.
The parents' point of view.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, it does not. I don't think that, to me, like from my experience, I have a very young mother,
mm-hmm.
You know, and so that discussion was never had, you know, between me and my mother. You know, she trusted, you know, I was exposed to a lot of things because of I didn't have a conversation with her.
Yeah.
You know, so I had to learn out. I had to go out and figure things out on my own.
But doctor, when you talk to parents and you lay out these numbers, which are relatively shocking and frightening, when you lay these out, they still don't want their children taught about this?
I don't think they really want. I think, you know, parents have too many other competing issues really here in their lives to worry about HIV. I mean, you think about all the other things that we face.
But we know that children are having sex.
We do know that. We definitely do know
that. It's not – they don't wait till they're married anymore. They don't wait till they're 21. They don't wait till they're 18. They don't wait till they're in high school. They have sex. Why don't we want to tell them how to protect themselves?
Well, I really can't answer that question. I can tell you that it's been just my, you know, experience that parents, for a lot of reasons, I think, have already said, you know, the issues of their own issues with uncomfortableness about talking about sexual issues. I think religion makes a big issue. You know, I find
it
ironic.
Is that why the American South has the higher incidence?
I find it so ironic that, you know, the place in the United States, which, you know, we know is the hotbed for at least some of the various religious orders, this is where this epidemic is going on here. And the church has really not stepped up to the game, I think.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about Dr. Cohen's research into this and what the implications of it may be for people going forward. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Creative Loafing, which is now taking submissions for its Flash Fiction Contest. Details at clclt.com/fiction contest. And Pearl Vision, providing annual eye exams, eyewear, and accepting major insurance plans, including iMed Vision Insurance, 5330 South Boulevard. Details at pearlvisioncharlotte.com. 2 days after the administration's deadline for fixing healthcare.gov, Diane Rehm and her guests get an update on the federal website for health insurance shopping, other rollout challenges, and political risks for both parties going forward. That's in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you have questions about HIV/AIDS or comments, you can join us at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks, and we're coming right back.
Hi, I'm Amy Rogers, editor of WFAE's food blog, WFA Eats, a great place to find new ideas and recipes for making the holidays more festive. Keep us in mind as you plan your holiday feasts for family and friends. And be sure to listen for more great food and cooking tips on The Splendid Table and America's Test Kitchen, weekend afternoons at 3 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. On the day after World AIDS Day, we're talking about HIV infection and transmission and the new treatments that are coming online or research that holds promise for making this an HIV-free world with Dr. Myron Cohen, who's a professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at UNC Chapel Hill. It is his research that we're talking about, or we will be talking about in this segment. Dr. Mark Johnson, a medical director of the CMC Infection Disease Clinic and a board member of RAIN, and Johnny Wilson is a young man, 21 years old, who's living with HIV, who contracted it at the age of... Treatment is expensive, isn't it, in this country? I mean, how much does it cost to get treated on a regular basis, which is daily, for HIV, Johnny?
Well, that's something that I actually don't know, because I've got so much help, you know, with the RAIN organization, with Ryan White. But without their help, you know, I've heard doctors let me know that treatment would be, you know, $1,000 to $25,000 a pill.
No, it's
a bottle. I'm sorry.
It's more like around $12,000 to approximately $20,000 a year.
A year
for antiretroviral therapy.
Bill Gates recently wrote an article about how the cost for treatment in Zambia went from an unaffordable $10,000 a year to 50 cents. If that is possible in Zambia, why isn't it possible here?
Well, in some of the developing countries, there are agreements for licensure of intellectual property, mainly antiretroviral medications, to be made by generic companies. There's a large generic manufacturer in India that is able to make some of the medications that we use currently here generically for a reduced cost.
Are they as effective? Are they as good? Are they as safe?
They are almost identical.
And we can't use them here?
We cannot.
Why not?
We cannot, because the rules of intellectual property does not allow those drugs to be imported into the United States.
So we're subsidizing third world countries.
We are not subsidizing. It's places like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other foundations that then are able to contract with these generic manufacturers and obtain these medications at a very low cost and treat individuals who are infected in these developing countries.
Now, Johnny Wilson referenced your organization, RAIN, the regional help me out with
the RAIDS, Regional AIDS Interfaith Network.
You help people. So does the Ryan White bill that helps people who cannot afford these drugs. They're monstrously expensive if you don't have insurance. They help these people get those drugs, pay for those drugs. Where does your money come from?
Well, the Ryan White money is a federal appropriation that is a little over $5 billion that is funded by the federal government to pay for HIV services here in the United States. And Ryan White basically pays for the medical bills, such as the doctor's visits, lab visits, and ADAP, which is a part of that total bill, pays for the drugs.
And what will happen to that money and that process of funding the ability to get drugs for people who can't afford them or who don't have insurance? What will happen to all of that under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there is a segment of the population that, based on their needs, that will actually probably be able to get insurance under the Affordable Care Act if you happen to live in a state that allows you to expand, you know, Medicaid.
But we don't. So what happens to those people?
So those individuals will then still have to go in and get basically insurance through the federal exchange based on their needs. And if not, then they could still probably get some funds through the Ryan White program.
And what happens if you barely qualify but do qualify for insurance under the Affordable Care Act? What happens to those people if they can afford it 1 year but they can't afford it the next year? What happens?
Can you clarify the question again?
Well, in other words, if you qualify this year to buy insurance and your income drops below a certain level and you fall into that category where if you lived in a state you would be helped by the expanded Medicaid program, but we don't live in that state. So next year you don't qualify for the subsidy and you can't afford to buy the insurance and you don't have insurance anymore. How do you get back on Ryan White, or can you?
Well, most of these patients, that as long as you're at least 138% federal poverty level, which should be roughly around $15,000, you should be able to get access through the health care reform at this particular time. So,
Go ahead, Dr. Cohen.
Let me just jump in. One thing, Mark, let me not interrupt you. Let me finish your thought.
Finish your thought.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Meyer.
I just think one thing, I see how the conversation would go, but you've got to understand, North Carolina, while we're talking about the problems with prevalence and finding new cases, the state has been terrific in terms of its support of detecting and making sure everyone with HIV is treated. It's like a tireless effort. So I think the Affordable Care Act is, of course, front and center on the minds of the people at the state level, trying right now to make sure that as Ryan White evolves, because it will evolve some, that everyone in North Carolina gets treatment. Because we've been through this for many, many years about making sure that treatment is available regardless of your income level. And I'd be shocked if all of a sudden they went away given the leadership of the state. This is one thing that the state of North Carolina is fantastically good at, is being concerned about public health aspects and treatment of patients with HIV. And Mark may want to chip in, but
I agree.
I'm very confident about this.
I agree. I think, you know, North Carolina Department of Health has been wonderful in terms of, we did have a backlog for, you know, at least waiting for drugs a few years ago, and with federal monies, that backlog went away. I don't think that's going to be a real issue here. I think the issue is just going to be that we have to understand that this funding stream, which is Ryan White funding, is going to have to continue in some shape and form to really act as a safety net for all individuals who are HIV positive.
If you were to become infected today, how long would it take for you to become detectable? In other words, if you had unprotected sex today and you were worried about it, how quickly could you be detected if you had a test?
Well, let me. In the state of North Carolina, here's another unique thing. What happens in North Carolina is we do the routine test. Historically, we've done a routine test, which takes a few days to become positive to a couple of weeks. But then, in addition, we've tested every sample to make sure that people aren't slipping through a crack with acute infection before their immune system can respond. And that's allowed us to treat people both with chronic infection and acute infection, something we haven't really talked about. It sounds like your guest might have had acute infection as a child for that month. So you asked me that question. But either way, now, this year, North Carolina will introduce a test that picks up something like 90% of people with acute infection within, I would say, 4 days of infection or 3 days of infection. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to slip through the cracks very often in the state.
And they have a state program that will allow all of these individuals who we identify in the acute phase at least to enter into care very quickly, so that they are, depending upon what region they are tested and where they live, they are referred to a regional center to actually speak to an HIV specialist to basically enter care.
So let me
add one thing. And virtually 100% of people with acute infection choose to go on treatment right away. And this gets into the cure field, because we know if we treat people immediately, we reduce the number of viral particles available in the long run. And our program and many others are working on trying to cure this infection, or at least modify it so people don't have to take a pill every day. And it's these people treated that have the opportunity to be treated immediately who have the best chance, I think, of being cured.
Well, let's talk about that, because you told one of our producers that the road to a cure might involve two different outcomes, one where a person can live with the virus without taking drugs, or an outcome where the virus is completely eliminated. So talk about both, if you would, Doctor.
Well, those are the two. There are groups all over the world now working on this with assiduously and with great speed, because we don't intend anyone to be taking these pills the rest of their lives if we can prevent it. And I would say, if you looked at 87 when everyone died to 2013, where it's a normal lifespan, it's obviously an incredible public health and treatment breakthrough that these drugs were developed. So now we have strategies that are really moving very fast of trying to either eradicate the virus completely from every cell in the body, that would be a true cure, or reduce the burden of viremia and control it so well with the immune system that pills are no longer necessary. So those are two complementary strategies, and both are being pursued very aggressively.
Where are we on the timeline, do you think?
I won't make a prediction except to say that people are working tirelessly on this, and that there's a lot of talk about, we learn a lot from rare events, like the Mississippi baby. We learned something about how a baby could be infected and then be cured if they're treated early enough, as far as we can tell. From the Berlin patient, where a transplant eliminated all the receptive cells and the patient was functional, was essentially cured. So we're learning a lot every year. There's a meeting this week starting tomorrow. The CURE meeting is in Miami, of I think limited to 300 or 400 people working on curing HIV worldwide.
Talk about that baby in Mississippi.
The Mississippi baby was not recognized. The baby was believed to be infected and treated very, very early, and later when the baby came back and was taken off therapy, there was no evidence that the baby was infected. So the only question is, was the baby truly infected when the therapy was initiated? My colleagues at NIH and at Johns Hopkins and other places have done this work to provide a compelling evidence that that very early treatment actually cured that baby, which then changes how we manage infants exposed to HIV. One thing we know we could deal with right now is eliminating mom-to-baby transmission worldwide. It's very rare in the United States. It's now it's still common, but becoming less common in developing countries. We have the tools to make this less than 1% from 30 or 40% just a few years ago. So those tools are being applied very aggressively.
Part of the problem with this disease, as I understand it, and I'm not a doctor, obviously, is that it hides. The virus hides in tissues in the body, and it becomes yes. undetectable, but it is still there. So in the case of this baby, what did we do to that baby that made that virus go away when we can't seem to do that in adults?
Well, I think one of the key things here is that with this child, we used combination therapy, multiple drugs here very early that probably prevented the reservoir or the sanctuary sites from being infected. And that's what happens usually with individuals who get infected with HIV. You have the seeding of the immune system and then subsequently the blood into the sanctuary sites that are hard to kind of, get rid of by the treatments that we use currently. But with this child was treated very early, multiple drugs, and probably really prevented that sanctuary site from being set up. And with these very ultra-sensitive techniques, we haven't been able to really find virus, at least in this child, to date. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the key points here.
Side effects. These drugs that some people have been taking for 25 years now, the initial side effects of the early drugs were horrific in some cases, probably maybe worse than the disease. What are the side effects of long-term use? Do we know what's happening inside the body, to organs, et cetera, for long-term use of these antiretroviral drugs?
I don't think we have the full history, in terms of what's going to happen with individuals who are on long-term therapy yet. We do know that the drugs that we use now are a lot safer. There are some medications that we do monitor very rigorously with, routine chemistries, especially for the kidney, things like that. I don't think we have the real answers to those questions.
When do you think that'll happen? Because some of these people, obviously, you're if you have HIV, you're dependent on
these drugs. Well, I think it goes back to what Myron was talking about earlier, that there is a bunch of individuals who are really working on this cure. And I think, one of our colleagues up at UNC, David Margolis, is working on drugs to actually wake up this virus that is in sanctuary sites to basically liberate the virus from the sanctuaries and deplete the body of virus. And so hopefully, if some of these strategies really work out over the long term, individuals like Johnny and others will probably be able to come off of their therapy at some point.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, they estimate that 10% of current college-age men who have sex with men are HIV positive, 10%. As many as 70% of African-American college-age men who have sex with men could be living with HIV. Is part of the problem here the reaction of the African-American community to homosexuality? Johnny?
That's the kind of touchy-touchy thing to, really talk about. But as far as living as being a black male, it's
you don't have to answer it if you
I don't want to answer that question.
All right, that's fine. It's all right. Resources. This hits people like a ton of bricks if they get a diagnosis of this, and some people who can't afford, who don't have insurance, have got to depend on people like RAIN and Ryan White and other organizations in this area and around the country for help to afford the treatments and the drugs. What resources are available for people?
There are a whole host of resources. I think, you know, you started talking about Ryan White and, you know, Medicaid and other medical sources for care. At least, you know, those are available if you're HIV positive and you can basically access them, and that's an issue in itself. But once you access them, the resources are there for at least for medical care, laboratories, and drug treatments. You know, RAIN, which is an organization that has been here within the Charlotte area for 20 years, I think is one of the premier aid service organizations. It really provides a whole host of services because we're not just talking about taking care of people, taking care of medicines, but we're really talking about taking care of individuals as a whole, you know, the body, the mind, you know, the whole package really here. And I think that's what RAIN brings to the table.
If you are HIV positive, can you safely have sex with another person who is not?
Yes. Protected.
You're asking, that's a kind of an empirical question. That's a tough question. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, the data shows a lot of babies now are born of moms, of father's HIV positive, mother's negative. The mother, the father's properly treated, the mother becomes pregnant, and now we're talking about in Africa, and the baby is born without HIV, and the mother remains negative. So in properly suppressed people, the probability of a transmission event becomes vanishingly low. But you still have to, you know, count on the person taking their pills and being properly suppressed and so on and so forth. So somebody who's in a discordant relationship where one person's positive and another's negative, they have a mutual reason to have safer sex whenever possible.
Let me stop you there, Doctor, because we are out of time. Dr. Myron Cohen, Professor of Medicine and Microbiology at UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. Mark Johnson, CMC Infectious Disease Clinic Medical Director, and Johnny Wilson. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production.